You're listening to Bedroom Beethovens, where notable music makers break down stories accompanied by songs and melodies documenting growth through their 10,000-hour journey. And me? Well, my name is Cello, your host.
I am a bedroom Beethoven.
What it is, what it does, episode 105 of the podcast is here. The dude with the fitted to the left is right back at it, 2021. My guest this week is...
Oh man, my name is Sky Du. I'm from Brooklyn, New York. I'm an MC, lyricist, songwriter. I'm also a ghostwriter for a lot of other people that everyone listening to has definitely heard of, bought records of, and is a fan of, but, you know, I can't get into who. As far as, you know, who I've worked with outside of ghostwriting, I mean, Jill Scott, Talib Kweli, Spike Lee, Black Thought, The Lox with Jadakiss and Styles, Dr. Dre, Tyrese, producer-wise, everybody under the sun. If you're a hip-hop fan, I done worked with everybody under the sun as far as producers, man. Whoever you name, we done got it in together. So, yeah, that's me on the music side in a nutshell.
I noticed you were being humble. You didn't list yourself as a producer. But
I'm the type of person where, like, I'm on my side of the fence, and everybody who's on the other side of the fence, you got to respect that. You know what I mean? You can't just roll up and be like, yo, I'm an actor now. Are you really? Because there's people who put a lot of time and effort into being an actor. So just because you in a few lines at the end of a show doesn't make you an actor. You know what I mean? I'm that type. So, you know, I did a few beats, you know, a few beats on my projects or whatever. But a producer is J57. A producer is Just Blaze. A producer is Madlib and Pete Rock, of course. And you know what I mean? Like, those are producers, you know what I mean? But I'm on the way. You know, I got a couple beats. Perpetrators, haters talk a lot of nonsense, this, that, and the third. But when Sky get the stomp and they sit back on their words, homie, I ain't deal with that bullshit. You bite my style, you block down on some paid full shit. I dry it up quick, I don't play with my music. If you don't got the heart or the talent, then you shouldn't do this. Everybody wanna shine, everybody spit bars, everybody got rhymes, and everybody click hard. When the truth is, none of your vehicles is ruthless. Having an imaginary burner can't do shit. But I do what I do, move how I move. My life's like a lost video from 2 Live Crew. Still got the hood on smash, so when I look over my shoulders, New York is looking right.
Oh, the great and powerful Sky Du is here. You know what's funny is, this is a little story. When I first got involved in corporate America, I went from a small city to the capital of Texas, working at an agency in a big skyscraper. So I ended up working with people who had come from all over the globe. Imagine a guy who grew up in Texas. I had no idea what a quarter water is, what a pair of wallabies or a brownstone. I mean, those things were foreign to me. But a coworker from New York came up to my desk and asked me what I was listening to. And it just so happened to be a track by Primo with Torre and Sky Du. And he was like, what on earth does a dude from this area know about Sky Du? So that was the angle I needed to befriend people from outside the limits of my geography. Music connects, that's for sure. So with that said, that was back in like 07, 08. So when you listen to this podcast episode, know that Sky Du's music has been injected in my veins for over a decade. So please enjoy this conversation, which leads up to his latest body of work, All the Brilliant Things, which should be released shortly surrounding the release of this episode. Shout out to my big brother J57 and the whole 5-7 collective, for without their support, there would be no podcast episode, I'm sure of it. Big things planned for 2021. And while I'm on the subject of big things, please rate this podcast 5 stars, leave a review, subscribe to the podcast on YouTube, hit me up on Twitter or Instagram. The hub where you can do all of that is bedroombeethovens.com, and I appreciate the support. Most people listen on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, but I like having a website. It's convenient, you know? You can buy a shirt there, you can sign up to be a Patreon, have access to early episode releases, and other cool things. And in turn, you keep the show ad-free. It's a win-win. All right, let's get into the episode. It all starts in New York, repping that 718. Let's get into it. Well, let me tell you, let me tell the people a true story. So I'm kind of just getting into the vinyl game at the start of 2015, and Me and My Friends comes out. It's on green vinyl. It's on
Fat Beat. Oh, Music for My Friends, yeah.
Music for My Friends. And I throw a Hail Mary. I send an email to Fat Beats, and I was like, hey, I'm new to collecting vinyl. Can Skyzoo sign it? And First Generation Rich sends over a lyric book. And you signed that too with the 718 area code written really big on the front.
Wow.
And when I got that, I was like, wow. Number one, is this how Skyzoo treats his fans? That's amazing. And number two, I was like, this is opening me up to a whole other experience, because sure, I can stream that album on Spotify, or I can hold a 12x12 cover art. I can get colored wax. It's signed by the artist. It's above and beyond. And since then, I have over 200 records. It's still one of my most special prized possessions. I almost want to credit you to me getting into vinyl, because it now it's an experience when I put on music. It's not just streaming music in the background. So I credit that to you.
That's crazy, man. Thank you. Thank you for the support, man. That's crazy. And you know what? I remember signing those lyric books. You know, I don't remember which one specifically got to you, obviously, but I remember when we did those limited lyric book runs and tagging them up. You know what I mean? Like, I do remember that. So when you brought that up, I hadn't thought about it since then. And that's why I was like, wow, like, oh, snap. I hadn't really thought about that, you know, because that's 5.5 years ago. But that's live, man. I appreciate it.
Speaking about 5.5 years ago, that's why I appreciate you coming on the podcast, because you know firsthand how hard it is to do these since you dipped your hand in the pool with the Chainlink Champions podcast.
Yeah. Oh, yo, you're really on it.
I think you know firsthand, like, to be consistent week after week after week, you got to have a more freed up schedule. It's hard.
It is, man. You know, basketball is another love of mine, but you know, it's it did take, you know, a little bit of time as far as, you know, trying to go about that. You know what I mean? And that is something I hope to pick up later on, you know, when time frees up a little bit more, you know.
Well, so let's take it back. So you're Skylar, better known to us as SKYZOO around the world. You reference yourself as Skylar when talking about early memories. Does that include everyone in your family or your friend A, or do close ones to you call you Gregory?
Nah, nobody calls me that. Everybody calls me Skylar. My first name is Gregory. My middle name is Skylar, and everybody calls me Skylar. Like, the only person who calls me Gregory, the only people who call me Gregory is the doctors and I guess the tax man, or when my checks come. That's it. You know what I mean? Like, everybody calls me Skylar. My parents, family, best friends, love on everybody. Like, that's my name. You know, it's kind of like LL. LL is James Todd Smith, but if you ever talk to him or meet him or talk to his family, he's Todd. You know, even though the J is for James and LL Cool J, he's Todd. You know what I mean? Like, he goes by his middle name. So it's the same with me.
I remember that. One of his albums was actually called Todd Smith.
Yeah, nah, he even though he got the J, he's Todd to everybody, you know, and I grew up the same way. My parents and everybody else from then on, everybody called me Skylar. That was it. So that's what it is.
And if I want to know what it's like growing up where you grew up, I guess I can just listen to old Biggie records, because you weren't too far away from St. James Place.
Yeah, I was on St. James Place. I grew up on St. James between Gates and Green, and Big was on St. James between Gates and Fulton. So it's literally up the block. I could walk from my crib to Big Crib in under a minute. Like 45 seconds if I catch the light.
It's gonna sound corny, but when you're around that area, there's gotta be a little bit of magic in the air, just a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, my world, you know, growing up, especially around that time, like, you know, from when Big was first starting to pop until, you know, right after he passed and everything, my world was Bad Boy World. Spin my V, smoke all my weed, tattoo on TT, saying B-I-G, now check it, you wanna be my man, squeeze, baby. That was it, you know what I mean? Like, that was my neighborhood. So, you know, I grew up on that. So regardless of, you know, people may look at me as on one side of the fence as far as the type of music I make, I'm a humongous Bad Boy fan, because that was my neighborhood. It was more than just my era and my generation. That was literally my neighborhood. You know what I mean? So, like, you can't say nothing bad about Bad Boy to me. Like, that's like family to me. Like, and I don't even know them, but that's like family to me. Like, they raised me because that was my neighborhood.
And as you grew up, your father, so if you're familiar with your discography, people should know how important Black fatherhood is to you. Your father moved to South Jamaica, Queens. I'm a little bit unfamiliar. Is that a step up from Bed-Stuy? Did that change the dynamic for you in any shape?
Not really. You know, Southside is dope, man. You're really on it. You got all your facts, man. The difference between Southside and Brooklyn is is a bunch of brownstones and projects. Southside Jamaica Queens is houses and projects. Like, you got projects no matter what, but then you got houses. You know what I mean? Like, you know, basements and all that. But it still go down, you know, like 50 Cent is from Southside, the whole G-Unit, Banks and Yayo, and that's all Southside. You know, it's houses, but it still go down, you know? So it's very similar to Brooklyn. It's very similar to the style. It's just, instead of brownstones, you got, you know, two-floor houses with a basement. But it still go down. It's still corner stores. It's still parks. It's still basketball courts. It's still activity. It's still predominantly Black neighborhoods. It's still the inner city. You just got houses instead of brownstones.
And you went to ICE, right? That's in Manhattan.
Yep. My gosh, you want it, bro. Yep.
So what's funny about that is minority enrollment. You mentioned a lot of minorities. It's 50% enrollment. And 25% of the students in ICE come from households where it's hard financially. So when you graduate from a place where a fourth of its students are used to being economically disadvantaged, dream killing, does that come into the territory? Like, do your peers care about education, or are they just like, oh, you want to be a big, successful CEO? Yeah, keep dreaming. Do you have momentum when you graduate from a place to do more?
First of all, I don't even think I knew those statistics about my school. I'm sitting here like, what? Like, I don't even think I knew those stats about my school. That's amazing, bro. You are really on it. It's really about where you grow up and like who raises you, right? Like, and I talk about that a lot in my music. You listen to music for my friends, you listen to Celebration of Us, you listen to, you know, Milestones, a lot of my records, I talk about all that type of stuff because I grew up in the same neighborhoods as my friends, right? Like, you know, literally, like, you know, obviously we was shoulder to shoulder with one another, but some of us chose to go left and some of us chose to go right. So if we grew up in the same places, we went to the same schools or whatever it might be, what was the difference? So the difference is who raised us and who was around us and who we had in our house and what that did to us and how we took heed to it. So for me, you know, my dreams was always music, but at the same time, you know, I had both of my parents and I had a third parent, you know, because my pops got married later on to my stepmoms, and I don't even call her a stepmom. I call her a second mom. So I was lucky. I had three parents instead of two. A lot of my friends had one. I had three. So I, you know, my odds was a little bit better, but it still was on me to take heed to that. You know, a lot of people grow up with both of their parents and don't run it the right way. And, you know, thank God I was able to run it the right way. So for me, just going back to the root of your question, you know, we all want to be something growing up. You know, we all do. We all want to be something growing up. ICE was a school. It was one of those upper schools, you know what I mean? Like, for lack of a better term, you know, it was one of those schools where, you know, you had to be of a certain cloth to be able to rock. And now it's gotten even crazier over the years. I think now it's like top 20 high schools in New York City, period, like in the five boroughs. But it still was high school, you know. And if you know high school, you know, there's activity in high school. You know what I mean? There's girls, there's smoke in the stairwell, there's dice games in the stairwell. That's any high school, you know what I mean? But, you know, at the same time, you know, ICE was a wonderful, wonderful place. And it definitely helped groom me to where I am now and the way I think and the way I create.
Yeah, because I don't want to candy coat it. You know, coupled with the fact that you grew up with friends who were locked up at 15, dead at 18, the fact that you're 38 and still on the rise, if you're a deeply spiritual person, you have to believe that you're here for a real reason, one that's bigger than yourself.
Oh, 100%. 100%. You know, there's a purpose and a reason for everything. And everything happens for a reason. I'm very big on that. I'm big on pros and cons. And, you know, with all of that, yeah, I mean, my calling, I believe, was to impact people as far as telling stories and people being able to relate and people, you know, seeing themselves in me when they hear me. You know, that's kind of what I feel my purpose is. And I know this is a gift that I have from God. I know that, you know, this isn't something where, you know, you just wake up and do it. You know, I mean, yeah, I'm nice, I'm talented and all that, but I work towards it as well. And all of that is an inner drive that I know comes from somewhere else. So I'm super aware of that, you know, and especially when you got people around you that go through certain things, like you said, you know, just growing up in certain environments, growing up with certain people. I mean, I got best friends who's doing 5 years. I got best friends who's doing 20 years. You know what I mean? Like, literally, like, I got friends in the feds right now, and then I got friends who, you know, a few of us made it. You know, more of us didn't make it than did make it, but there are a few of us, you know, a few friends of mine that I got standing beside me that made it, you know? So it's just a testament to the way the dice roll.
Once you make it, though, you need a really good strategy. I think you had an amazing strategy because when you met Ninth Wonder, well, like 15 years ago, I think the hustle was Ninth would give you some beats, and in turn, you put lyrics on those beats, and then you give him a tape. You told him to hear it. Like, if I wanted to work with Apollo Brown, I could make an unofficial tape of me rapping over 10 of his beats and then tell him to check it out, and you never know. I think that's pretty smart.
Yeah, but, you know, it wasn't planned. That definitely was the way it rolled out, but when I met him, my plan wasn't, yo, I'm going to get all these beats, make a tape and give it to him and then get him to get down with it. Like, that, it wasn't planned. It was really organic. You know, when I met him through my man Sean Don, obviously of the Justice League. And, you know, we met first, and then he took my music to North Carolina and was telling them, yo, we got to get with this kid, Sky Zoo. Yo, he's super dope. Young kid out of Brooklyn. I mean, at the time, I might have been 23, you know what I mean? Something like that. And he was just telling them, yo, man, this kid is nice, man, you know, whatever, whatever, whatever. And, you know, he was playing my music for them, and then they brought me down. They hit me and was like, yo, come down to North Carolina for like a week and let's vibe. I went to North Carolina, and this was 2005. I went to North Carolina, and I did 15 records. I had Crisis Beats, Ninth Beats for 10 beats, and I had one Illmind beat. This is actually how I met Illmind. And, you know, so I did all this work with them, and me and Knife got really, really tight. You know, I was tight with all of them just from that week, but me and Knife really clicked crazy. And it became a thing over the next year where every time he would see me, he would just give me beats. Every time he would see me, it became like a running joke. Like, yo, Sky, here go the beats. Yo, Sky, here go some new beats. Yo, Sky, here go some beats. So I wound up with like 8-10 CDs of beats, and every CD had like 15-20 beats on it. So you do the math, I had over 100 beats easily. I had tons of beats from Sun. You know what I'm saying? Like, it was crazy. And one day I was home, and I was bored listening to the radio and the mixtape scene. And I said, yo, man, let me throw on some beats, man, just to have something to listen to. I said, yo, I got all these Ninth beats I never did nothing with. Like, I'm bugging. Meanwhile, I got a job. I'm a regular guy. Nobody knows me. I got a job. You know, I'm trying to get my music off the ground. And I got beats from the new Jay-Z producer. You know what I mean? And I was like, yo, I got all these beats I never did nothing with. And I just started pulling beats together. Like, yo, I want to mess with this. I want to mess with that. I want to mess with that. And then it seems like you know the story. You know, I did 9 joints in 2 days in New York. And then I booked a trip to North Carolina like a week later. On my own dime, with my own little 9-to-5 money, I booked a trip to North Carolina, told Sean Don I was coming. Could I crash at the crib? He was like, of course, no problem. And when I got down there, I gave the CD to Ninth. Like, yo, check this out when you get some time. The next day, he called me screaming on the phone like, yo, bro, this is amazing. What is this? Like, what is this CD? This is crazy. And I was like, yo, man, like, you know, I was bored at home and I just started to cook up. And he was like, yo, meet me at the studio later today. Let's finish it. And we did 3 joints in 1 day. And that's how it became 12 joints in 3 days. Cloud 9, you know?
Yeah, Apollo Brown was just on the podcast. He told me y'all did y'all's album in a week. I mean, the pace is crazy.
That story's crazy. I went out there. He probably told the whole thing, but I went out there for 2 weeks. My head up. It was slow though, then it sped up. It's like I'm being pulled down. Funny how I keep my head up. It was slow though. But originally, you know, when he sent me the beats like 3 months earlier, his process is if he does an album with you, he'll send you all the beats like 3 months out. You pick what you want and then you write over like 3 months. Then you go to Detroit for like 4 days and just record them. Boom, boom, boom. You recording like 6 joints a day and you're done because you wrote them ahead of time. And I told him, I was like, yo, I'm going to need more than 4 days because I write on the spot. So he got worried. He was like, yo, man, you're going to be down here for like a month. The hotel fee is going to be crazy. The rental car is going to be crazy. I said, bro, I promise you, give me 2 weeks and we done. He was like, nah, man, you ain't write nothing yet. I was like, I ain't write nothing, bro. I don't write ahead of time. I write on the spot in the studio. And he was worried. He was scared. He was like, yo, we're going to have to extend the trip, the hotel prices. You're going to spend mad budget money on the hotel. I said, bro, I promise you we're going to be done in 2 weeks with the whole joint. We was done in 9 days. We had mad days left over to hang out and go to Motown Museum and run around Detroit and eat food. And you know what I mean? Like, we did, what is it, 15 joints in 9 days. And he was blown. He was like, yo, I can't believe you did that. I was like, yeah, I write on the spot, and I'm blessed to be able to write quick. So that was how that happened.
You should have let him know, like, hey, you know, self-confidence is not something I lack. I was in a group called the Grits. You can't be called the greatest rappers in the streets and be doubtful of your own abilities, you know?
You know, he knew what it was, but, you know, I get it. You know, I get it as a producer. You know, a lot of rappers may be like, yo, I could write quick, I could do this and that, and then they might get stuck and write one song over 3 days, and now the clock is ticking. So I understand, you know what I mean? I wasn't offended at all. I get it, because a lot of people don't write on the spot. A lot of people don't write quick. You know what I mean? You hear the Jay-Z stories and all that, but other than that, a lot of people don't write on the spot or write quick. So I understand. You know, I wasn't mad at all. I was like, when I get there, all his worries is going to be washed away. It ain't nothing. I wasn't worried about it. I was like, I know when I get there, we're going to do 2-3 joints a day. We're going to be done in no time, and we was done in 9 days.
Now, for those who don't know, you were in Sean Price's personal top three, Sean, of course, being a legend taken too early. Do you have any Doom stories that you haven't told publicly?
Nah, I never met Doom.
Never met him? Because, I RIP to another great, but I remember you were chilling with Mac Miller when he went by Larry Fisherman back in the day.
Yep, absolutely. Wow, yeah, man. Rest in peace, Mac. Rest in peace, Doom. Of course, rest in peace, my brother, Sean P, of course. P was my bro, man. That was my man, man. That was my man.
Yeah, I'm not one for what ifs. I'm really not, and I hate to even plant the seed, but once every couple months, I think about a world where if Priority Records never merged into Capitol Records and Duck Down never would have truly went independent, you guys would have been the big time signing Eminem to Duck Down. Instead of Dre and 50, it would have been Druha, Sky Zoo, and Eminem on the cover of that XXL, maybe.
Yeah, because I always heard the stories about how he wanted to be there, you know, because he grew up as such a fan of them, and who didn't at that time, you know what I mean? So I always heard the stories how he wanted to be there and how much he supported them and, you know, and loved them and all that. And Duck Down is great, man. That was my first. They're not a major label, but, you know, in like jumping off point, you know, I was with Knife and Jamla and all that for sure. And the Jamla situation was through Duck Downs. It was like a co boutique label deal thing, like Jamla / Duck Down. You know, that was the vibe of that. So it was dope, man. And, you know, Duck Down being Brooklyn, of course, you know, and P, you know, Sean P is how that deal kind of finalized, you know what I mean? Like Sean P was very instrumental in my deal happening, so it was dope.
I think about it every now and then, but you know, here's something that people don't talk about enough, and that's Ray Copeland, DMX is his nephew. But before all that, little back history: he was born in Mount Vernon. Ray Copeland attended Mount Vernon High School. He went to school with Pete Rock. He went to school with CL Smooth. He went to school at Heavy D, P Diddy. So in turn, he witnessed the evolution of hip hop firsthand. And while, you know, he was enthused by the emergence of the sound that we call hip hop, he decided that his career would take a different path. He went into academia. So when it was time to form the Rough Riders, he left academia. So now you have a guy who possessed, you know, the street savviness and the business acumen to kind of guide and direct the careers of the Rough Riders. You know, I didn't see the documentary on the Rough Riders, but based on that sentence alone, you have to wonder how much of the success of Rough Riders lied on his shoulders. Can you tell me a little bit about how you guys connected and maybe what you learned from him at an early age?
And my man Joe Buck linked us up. So Joe Buck is a phenomenal illustrator, graphic artist. He did all the De La Soul stuff that you know of, like the logos and the De La Soul is Dead with the flower pot and all that stuff. That's Joe Buck. Joe Buck is from Queens. He lived in Long Island, but he's a Queens guy. I think Joe was from Hollis. So he went to college with De La, and he did all their stuff. So however he knows Uncle Ray, I'm not sure. But Joe plugged me with Uncle Ray back in the early 2000s. And, you know, me and Uncle Ray started rocking. And we worked for about a year, year and a half. And, you know, Ray was great, man. You know, I learned a lot from Ray as far as the business side, the way it works. Because you're talking about somebody who had immense success by the time I got with them. You know, it wasn't somebody who was coming up as a manager while I'm coming up as an artist. And there's nothing wrong with that, you know. But you're talking about somebody who had already sold millions of records with their artists, already been on worldwide tours with the biggest artists in the game for a 5-year run, you know, all that type of stuff. So it was dope to be able to have somebody who really is on that side of the fence show you what it is. And Ray was great, man. You know, much love to Ray for sure.
Yeah, even though you rep Brooklyn, man, Mount Vernon and you, it runs deep from Uncle Ray to doing an album with Pete Rock. You even performed the King Above the Rim Celebrity Basketball Challenge at the Mount Vernon High School, at the actual high school, about 6 years ago. So you and Mount Vernon have history.
Yeah, yeah. Nah, it's real, man. It's real. Gosh, you know everything, bro. I forgot about that, man. You may hear me continue to say that over and over, but yeah, you know everything, bro. This is crazy. Yeah, I forgot all about that. Yeah, I remember it now that you said it. I'm looking at the day I was there. Yeah, that's crazy. But yeah, shout to Money Earning, man. Shout to Money Earning Mount Vernon. Of course, Pete, of course, without a doubt. And CL. You know, I worked with CL some years ago, and, you know, it's all love.
Yeah, you've been around producers your whole life, even if you're on the video set of Everybody Knows. You know, Kanye West was on that set, Chad Hugo, Pharrell. You're doing joint projects with Apollo Brown, Ant-Man Wonder, Pete Rock. J57 is kind of, you know, mentoring you a little bit. I compare this to an actor like Denzel Washington. You know, he does Malcolm X, he does The Hurricane, he does Training Day, and before you know it, he's directing Fences, Antoine Fisher, The Great Debaters. He didn't need to go to film school. He got the ultimate hands-on training. So if you're paying attention, there's no way you can be around all these producer giants and not want to try your hand at it yourself, right?
The way I got into kind of toying around with beats is just having an ear. You know, it starts with having an ear. You can't be a producer and not have an ear, like, period. And you know what I mean? Like, that's, you know, it's asinine if it's any other way. So I've always been blessed with having an ear. I've been told, you know, of course, the rhymes and the lyricism and all that. But on top of it, I've been told, yo, man, you got one of the best ears for beats. Like, I just always pick what people consider to be great beats. I remember, Nod Factor? My man Jerry Barrow did a list of like the greatest beat pickers in hip hop, and it was me, Rick Ross, The Game, Lil B. It was and they had me on there like, yo, it's one of the greatest beat pickers in hip hop. So I say all that to say, when you picking beats and you got an ear for it, you obviously know what you want it to sound like, and you know what makes sense sonically and musically. So you may have a one up as far as making beats. The thing with me is the technical side, you know, like the machinery and working all the gadgets and gadgets, like I like to call it. That stuff I haven't figured out all the way yet, like somebody like a Pete Will or, you know, all those type of guys that you name. Like, of course, they're masters at their craft. I haven't figured that part out yet, but the music I know, you know what I mean? Like, I know the music. I know samples. I know timing. I know swing. I know pocket. I know all that stuff for sure. And the first person to tell me that I should start making beats many, many years ago was Crisis. Messing with Crisis 15 or so years ago, Crisis told me that. Though he was the first person to ever tell me that. He was like, yo, you should start making beats, man, because your ear is bananas. Like, you hear everything, the way you approach a beat, your pocket, even the samples that you give to me and other producers, like, yo, chop this, chop that. I'll get a record and show you everything I want. Yo, take this part and then go to this, skim forward on this part, then take that. And then for the third part, I want you to go back to the beginning and take this. Like, I could construct the whole beat. I just don't know how to use the tools the way some of these other guys do, you know, the technical standpoint. But I know how to build a house. I just don't know how to, you know, work all them tools in the box. You know what I mean? So that's kind of what it is.
You know, when you did Freestyle Friday on 106 in Park, I think Timbaland was the judge. Were you able to, like, hey, man, like, you got any advice for me or anything? Or is it like, hey, don't talk to the guests? Like,
you're just... No, it wasn't either or. You know, Tim was cool. You know what I mean? It wasn't either or. But we didn't, like, vibe with them or nothing like that. You know, they kind of was in and out. I remember I worked with this girl who was, I forgot her name, man. I'm sorry, Shorty. I forgot her name. But it was this girl who was a producer, and she was kind of under him. Like, she was kind of training under him. And I worked with her kind of through that. I met her. I forgot how I met her, man. But she was dope. She was making beats and she was working with Jimmy, his engineer, and she was kind of being trained under him and all that. But now we, you know, we didn't vibe with, like, we didn't get to click with them like that. But they was cool. It wasn't like don't talk to them. It, you know, it was cool.
I mean, I have a theory. You probably, you know, I'm sure you've moved well on from this, but I have a theory that no matter how dope of an opponent you were, Jin was going to win anyways because they needed a rating scenario. Like, let's take an Asian kid. He's going to win week after week no matter what so we can build a narrative and make television magic. And I felt like maybe you were a victim to that. No matter how dope you were, you weren't going to win. That's my conspiracy
theory. Yeah, a lot of people felt that way. A lot of people felt that way. I was 19, so you couldn't tell me that. You know what I mean? But a lot of people felt that way. And, you know, moving forward, like, again, like you said, I don't, you know, I never think about it because it's literally been, wow, this year makes 19 years. So
I'm sorry, man. I'm sorry we're digging in the past so far back.
I never, like, really go back to just because it's been so long, not because of anything else, but just because it's been long. Me and Jen is actually real cool. You know what I mean? We don't speak super often, but we're really cool. Like, I remember being on tour in, where was I at? I was doing this China run, and it was like Beijing and Hong Kong and a couple other places. And I remember being in Hong Kong, walking down the street and running into him in Hong Kong in the middle of the day. And he literally stopped and was like, yo, what are you doing in Hong Kong, bro? And like gave me a hug and we chopped it up. I was like, bro, I'm out here on tour. And he was like, what? Yo, you're in Hong Kong? He was like, yo, where's the show? I'm there. And, you know, he came to the show that night and we vibed and bugged out and all that. And that's the homie. Like, it's all love. Once in a while, you know, somebody will tweet something, you know, about back then. And, you know, he'll tag me and be like, yo, Skyzoo was the one out of everybody. And, you know, I'll respond, yo, much love, bro. So, you know, it's cool, man. You know what I mean? We've all, you know, we've done our thing. You know, he's doing what he's doing. You know, I'm definitely doing what I'm doing, you know, and, you know, we good. You know, I mean, it's all love. You know, it ain't no thing at all. It's love and much love to him and success to him. And I'm rocking on my path and everything is great.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a good story. And as a fellow jazz fan, we got to talk about good stories. We both know that if you want a good story, you got to dig into the history of jazz. Like, for instance, my favorite trumpeter is Lee Morgan. And I know of the incident where he was he was so fucked up that he didn't realize that a heater was burning his scalp. Not waking up. Yeah. I remember seeing when he had the crazy hair, kind of like a straightened comb over. And I thought it was just a style that he was after, but he was hiding his scars. I mean, his wife who saved him, loved him, and eventually shot him to death. She only did 3 years for killing her husband. Jazz is something else, man.
And that was just while she was waiting. You know what I mean? Like, I'm a huge Lee Morgan fan, so it's crazy that you said that. Lee Morgan is probably my second favorite trumpet player after Miles, of course. I love Lee Morgan. I love everything Lee Morgan. You know what I mean? Like, I absolutely adore his music, man. Like, Lee Morgan is my guy as far as, you know, all of that. The only person, for me personally, who has the one-up on him is Miles, which is why I named my son Miles. But Lee Morgan is that guy. Like, I got tons of Lee Morgan vinyl. I'm trying to get them all. You know, I got every Miles vinyl ever done. Every album Miles ever did, I have on vinyl. So I'm trying to do the same with Lee Morgan. I got, like, half, maybe two-thirds. But, yeah, Lee Morgan is, man, he is absolutely amazing.
Are you a Sidewinder man or a Search for the New Land man?
A little more Search for the New Land, more Gigolo, more Cornbread, more the last album with the Angela Davis joint. All of it, though. I love it all. I'm a huge Lee Morgan fan. All of the sides, but all of me is fine. On the vibe, I'm like Lee Morgan of the style. There it go, now there it go, now there it go, there it go, now there it go, now there it go, there it go, now there it go, now there it go, there it go, now there it go, now there it go, for who looking there. You take a look around, now I took it there. Yeah, there it go, for who looking there. You let me know how it's looking here. There it go, now there it go, now there it go, there it go, now there it go, now there it go, there it go.
Yeah, I heard Netflix is doing a documentary on Wayne Shorter, but I would love to see a movie come out about jazz musicians making music and not just about how hard their lives were. You know, I was excited for the Miles movie, but it ended up being an action flick. And I get it.
Yeah.
But think of how, you know, think of how narrow the audience for the documentary would become.
The documentary was great, though. The documentary was like excellent. You know what I mean? It was, you know, the documentary was more along the lines of what you said you were looking for, you know, where they just talked about his life and how great the music was. Of course, you got to get into certain elements that happened, but Miles' life was a triumph. You know what I'm saying? You could say Lee Morgan's life obviously was a tragedy because of the way it went down and it ended so short, but Miles' life was a triumph. You know what I mean? So, like, that documentary was great. But the Lee Morgan documentary, as sad as the story is, man, I've watched that thing like 20 times. You know what I mean? Like, and I think the brilliance of it is the fact that so many people did not know the story. Like, if you weren't a diehard jazz head, you didn't know that story. You know, that wasn't something that was pumped like that because it was so long ago. You're talking 40 something years ago, and it wasn't Miles. It wasn't Train. It wasn't, you know, Charlie Bird. You know, it wasn't Bird. You know, it was Lee Morgan, who, if you're a jazz head, you know Lee. But if you're a casual jazz head, you may or may not know him. And I think that was the brilliance of the documentary and why so many people was drawn to it.
I love that. And that's kind of what I was trying to do with my podcast. Like, imagine if there's a Sky Zoo movie, a 40 Acres and a Mule production, of course, and we're not focusing so much on the grief. We're at Stanley Morgan, and you're sitting on 100 Ninth Wonder beats, and nobody knows. Like, that shit's fascinating to me. You know, that's a scene in a movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Nah, for sure, man. For sure. It's been a wild ride indeed.
And that all leads us to all the brilliant things. And because of the pandemic, you were able to take your time, go through the themes, the lyrics with a fine-tooth comb, really take your time and be patient. And in turn, in your words, one of the most complete lyrical and poetic albums you've ever done. So at least one good thing has come from isolation and overcoming hurdle after hurdle in 2020.
Yeah, you know, I've never taken this long to make an album. Part of it was by choice. Part of it was, well, I didn't have a choice, you know, from my, you know, from my voice and the surgery I had, which put me down a couple months to, you know, actually, I had a back injury that nobody knew about. You know, I had like kind of pulled my back, and like, I remember writing and recording on meds, like my back was gone. You know what I mean? Like, you talk about pain, like there's nothing in the world like back pain. You know what I mean? Like, I was literally working on the album, excruciating pain. Like, it was hard to stand up in the booth, but I had a self-inflicted deadline. You know, I had a self-imposed deadline, and I was like, yeah, I got to make this deadline. Granted, that deadline came and went 100 times, you know, because of the Rona and my voice and whatever, whatever. But I had this deadline in my mind, and I was like leaning on the wall in the booth while I was rhyming. Like, I couldn't stand up, but I had to do it. And I was writing through the pain, and I was on meds and all that when I was writing. But it was crazy. So, you know, it's never taken me this long to make an album. And it's dope, you know. I just was able to sit there and write and record something and read it and listen to it back 100 times. And then go in and maybe tweak one line and be like, I want to change this one line. I'm coming back tomorrow to the studio and I'm going to change this one line, you know, like stuff like that, you know. So it was dope. It's a really, really incredible album. I'm super excited about it. It is jam packed. I told myself I wasn't going to jam pack it this much, and I absolutely did the opposite. It is jam packed as far as lines. I mean, there's records on there with no hooks. It's just rhymes and lines and lines and lines, and just like, yo, hold up. Like, it's a whole lot of that. Like, wait, bring that back. It's tons of that, like more than ever before. So it's dope and it's deep. Everything has this meaning to it, and the whole thing is a story, and it's really special.
I remember first hearing about it in 2019, so it's been a while in the making. And in fact, it kind of reminds me the anticipation, the wait, how it builds excitement. Like, remember in high school for you, how magical it was when Hard Knock Life Volume 2 or Black Star or Aquemini came out. And because now it's just New Music Fridays, and my kids just get a whole dump of music on Fridays, and then they forget about it a week later. But I remember going to the record store, and there'd be albums like UGK's Riding Dirty or Goody Mob, and those albums were announced 6 months ahead of time. You marked your calendar, you rode your bike to the shop, you stood in line, you ran home frantically, you took the shrink wrap off, you popped the tape in your deck. I think if you're a Sky Zoo fan, it's like, I'm sure you get barraged on social media. When's it coming out?
Yeah.
But I love the anticipation, man. I love that weight. It builds something.
There was times back in the day in school where you had all this anticipation for an album and somebody might let you down. You know, you might get the joint and be like, yo, we've been waiting for this for months. And, you know, Clue was teasing us with records and dag, man, Clue had all the best records because the other records is weak. You know what I mean? Like those was, you know, sometimes you had those situations and then sometimes you had a record where it came out and you ran to the store and got it and it just blew you away and it was everything you wanted and then some. I mean, I remember, what was that, summer 97, I was in summer school. It was the only time I ever went to summer school in my life. I was in summer school and No Way Out came out. And I remember like getting out of summer school at 12 o'clock. I think I got to the record store at 12:05 and the record store was like 20 minutes away. I think I got there at 12:05. Like I was gone. I blew to the record store and got the tape. And that was it. That was all I listened to for 3 months straight. That was it. You know, so like it's, you know, those were what made it special. And hopefully the music I'm making continues that lineage, you know, regardless of the sound being different. It's that excitement and that drive and all that energy of like, yo, this is what I needed. I've been waiting on it. I can't stop playing it. Like, that's what it's about.
Here's the greatest compliment I can afford you is an album you released 10 years ago. I believe it was The Salvation, the album that was in you since the age of 9. And yes, now, you know, we know the story. The first albums you release towards the front of your career tend to be the best because you have 20 years to tell it. You have 20 years of experience and 20 years to figure out exactly how you want it to be. And you're in class listening to Heart Knock Volume 2. You're writing your own verses like you're on every song. You're ready, coach. Put me in. But for you, it doesn't stop there. The Celebration of Us comes out, and you go on record and say, oh, this is my best record to date. The Brilliance of It All comes out. This is my best lyrical album to date, guys. You are how it's supposed to be. You get better with age. Your skill set sharpens like iron. And with each record, it's not a publicity stunt. The material just gets better and better. So I feel like if you're a true Sky Zoo fan, you're spoiled. You make a conscious effort to add another solid body of work to your catalog.
Man, that's real. Thank you, man. I appreciate that. And, you know, that's the goal, man. Like you said, you know, it's not about somebody dropped the album and it was cool, but the person says, well, you know, I still did so-and-so 10 years ago. That's what's carrying me. Nah, like, you know what I mean? It's not about that. It's about every time you go, you're supposed to strive to make it better than the last. Of course, people going to have their favorites. There's people who favorite album is Music for My Friends or Dream Deferred or The Easy Truth or Retropolitan or In Celebration of Us or Live from the Tape Deck. And you know what? That's the beauty of it, because if it's kind of like if you look at one album, right, and like everybody's favorite song is one song, you didn't do your job. You're supposed to make it difficult for people. If you got 15 people in the room, everybody's favorite record is supposed to be a different record. Yo, my favorite record is track 3. My favorite record is track 5. Yo, my favorite record is track 12. That's when you know you got it. That's when you know you did it right. If everybody's favorite record is track 3, something happened that was wrong. You know what I mean? Like, it's about the argument being there between the fans. Like, yo, yeah, I love The Easy Truth, but yo, my favorite is A Celebration of Us. Yo, man, I love Retropolitan, but my favorite is Live from the Tape. Like, that's what it's about. It's supposed to be the back and forth. And if every joint in your catalog can be argued to be the best in that catalog and the best of that year and the best from that artist, then you're doing your job. And that's what I do. And that's my goal. And I came from that, you know, like, I grew up the block from Big. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I grew up on Ray and the GZA and Nas and Jay and, you know, 3000. And, I, you know, 1995, I was 13. And that was the greatest year ever in the history of mankind. It was 1995. Like, I came from that, you know? So this is what it is. It can only be this way.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but for me, and I haven't heard the album yet, obviously, but all the Brilliant Things sounds optimistic. And with everything we've covered, with all the loss, the health issues, the pandemic, all the Brilliant Things could have easily become your Black album or your version of the Black album. Is there any anger on this album? Is there frustration, or were you making a conscious effort to keep things positive?
Nah, it's yeah, you kind of in it. You know what I mean? Like, there's definitely moments of, okay, so the album, the concept is out there a little bit, so I could break it down. The album is about gentrification and Black culture and the thievery of it. And it's all the Brilliant Things, because when you look at the way this was done, yo, it's kind of brilliant. The way this game was played, it's disgusting and it's infuriating. But when you look at it, you're like, yo, this was a brilliant scheme that these people did on us. And so that's why it's called All the Brilliant Things. Like, these are the things that made it go that way. And the album is all conceptual. It starts with the way our neighborhoods were, and it ends with the way our neighborhoods are now. And it kind of takes you on this roller coaster ride. And within the gentrification, there's also the element of culture vulture and how the two go hand in hand. You know, something that they didn't want to now they can't get enough of, and they're trying to take from you and tell you what really is what it is and what's not what it's not, when I don't know if they have that right. And, you know, so that's what it's about. And yeah, it's a play on it where it's like this really was a brilliant sting job that, you know, people pulled off. Wow. You know what I mean? Like, that's what it comes down to.
Love it, man. Well, this is the end of the line for us. Is there anything else about the project that I didn't cover? But if there's anything that I missed that you want to promote, feel free.
Oh, man. Man, you covered it all. I've never done an interview where somebody was this tuned in with my background and my story, man. Like, that's why I kept saying it throughout it. Like, wait, what? Like, yo, I mean, everything you said, obviously, I've said in interviews, but I may have said this part in an interview 10 years ago and then that part in an interview 5 years ago, and you got it all. Like, you got the whole thing collected, and that's amazing. Hats off to you. I don't really got much to add, man. You know what I mean? All the brilliant things coming soon. I'm actually mixing as we speak. Trying to get it out ASAP because it has been a while and I'm excited for people to hear it. And it really, really, really is an extremely tall body of work. It's a lot to digest. It's a lot to break down. You're going to need your laptop. You're going to need your Wikipedia page open. You're going to need your Genius page open. You're going to need all that. And you're going to just sit there and just get it. Or maybe you don't. Maybe you don't. And you're listening to it and you're like, yo, I get it. I get this. But they come in flurries, man. It is an avalanche. It is not a sprinkle of a snow day. It is an avalanche, you know. And I'm proud of it. It's insane, man. It's a really, really great body of work. So that's it, man. And shout to you for putting this together. I know we've been trying to get together for a minute. So shout to you for putting this together, man, and just being on it. Like I said, I never had an interview that was like this. It's crazy. So I appreciate it.
Hey, I want to thank you for telling me not to buzz off, because I feel like I was hounding you to be here. But I hope it was worthy of your time.
It's all love, man.
I'm a fan. I'm going to continue to champion your music. And I want to wish you a fruitful 2021. Peace to you and your family.
Likewise, man. Thank you. Much love and salute always.